it's Diane. Great to be with you. I'm on vacation for the next couple of weeks, so my producers and I dug into our archives to put together some shows while I'm gone. This week, on the 4th of July, we celebrate the adoption of the Declaration of Independence, but few Americans have actually read the document in its entirety. So today, we listen back to my 2014 interview with Harvard professor Danielle Allen, author of the book Our Declaration. In it, she argues the core of the Declaration is as much about equality as it is about liberty. Tell me what happened while you were teaching that night school class and what it was that brought you to write this book.
So the class had about 20 students in it, and it was a one-year course in the humanities. The students did philosophy, U.S. history, literature, art history, and thinking and writing course. And over the course of my 10 years teaching in it, I rotated among several of those units. And the goal of the class was always to introduce students to high-quality writing, smart thinking, and to push their own thinking and their writing capacities. And the Declaration was just the perfect text for doing this. It's short. Right? That was an amazing advantage to it. Nobody could complain about the reading. These were very busy people, hardworking, juggling children and childcare and multiple jobs and so forth. And so I really just started for a pragmatic reason. But as I read it with them in the context of history, philosophy, literature, I found it incredibly empowering for them. I was really stunned to learn that none of my students had ever read the Declaration of Independence. It took me a while to get my head around that, the idea that they didn't think of it as belonging to them, and nobody else had ever made the suggestion that the text belonged to them. And so over the course of reading the text closely, that was really the big discovery for all of us, that it was our declaration. It was theirs. It was my students. It was my night students' declaration. And it was directly empowering in their own lives, in their personal experience as they thought about their own work trajectories, their own educational trajectories, and empowering of them as citizens as they realized they had a claim, they had a stake on our political institutions.
And you subtitled the book, A Reading of the Declaration of Independence in Defense of Equality.
Exactly. So we spend so much time talking about the idea of hypocrisy around the Declaration, that it's got this bold statement, all men are created equal, but how can we really think that the folks who wrote that and signed it believed it when we know that so many of them were slave owners and slaveholders and so forth? And reading it with my students, really just starting at the beginning and working our way through to the end, I became convinced that there is a coherent philosophical argument about equality in the text. And it's not just in that famous second sentence. It works its way all the way through. And it's so philosophically powerful that it merits our attention and our respect, even if we may disagree with parts of it and want to debate its historical context.
So you think that most of us, not just your students, but most of us, have not read the Declaration?
Well, that's my basic experience. I know a lot of people listen to it on NPR every year on the 4th,
exactly.
Or you know, there are various other public
sure.
readings. But every time I've asked an audience how many people have actually read it from start to finish, and it's only, 1,337 words, every time I ask, I never get, even half the audience to raise their hand. So that tells me that as a society, we really aren't reading this document at the moment.
Well, the other aspect of this is that most of us put the emphasis on independence, and you're putting the emphasis on equality.
That's right. I think one of the fundamental arguments of the Declaration is that we build our political institutions together based on equality in order to secure our independence. So our political institutions are among the most valuable instruments that we have for, in fact, achieving liberty. But then the interesting thing is that those institutions have to be based on a foundation of equality if they're going to remain strong. In that regard, equality becomes the foundation for liberty.
But was equality necessarily implied at the writing?
Absolutely. And again, if you just even look at the first sentence, right, you get the idea of equality right in the beginning when they declare their separate and equal station with other nations on earth. And so that's a claim that together, building political institutions, they've achieved an equality which brings them independence. It brings them freedom from domination by France and England and Spain and all the rest of those great powers at the time. And to me, the interesting thing about that idea is it's not just that they were claiming freedom from domination for their whole collective assembly of now states. They were claiming that for individual citizens as well, that as we get our freedom through participating in this shared endeavor. And it's so again, our freedom depends on the egalitarian bond that makes us a community capable of protecting us all simultaneously.
Now, that same phrase, separate and equal, is used by segregationists to create a very different framework.
Well, it's an echo. And so what happened, we all know the phrase separate but equal, right? And this is one of those, you know, powerful moments in my class when I was teaching the course originally, that we all just sort of sat up when we were reading the text out loud and we got to separate and equal and we realized, you know, wow, that echoes. We know that. Why do we know that? Oh, right. We know it because of all the separate but equal language used to defend segregation. And so then you have this sort of eerie recognition that this language that was powerfully developed to support a liberation had been twisted, that and changed to a but in order to support segregation and domination.
So you're trying to help us perhaps re-understand.
That's right.
The Declaration.
That's right. My book, I really think of as an invitation to everybody to read the document and then work out its argument for yourself. I mean, each of us, I think, has the capacity to work out the argument of the Declaration. And in the process of doing that, one will be required, I think, to meditate on the ideal of equality.
Now, what in your own life would you say brought you to this point?
You know, it's a lot of different components. I mean, there's no question that I have a love of this country and a love of its political institutions, a love of its founding that comes from both of my parents and both sides of my family. So on my father's side, African-American side of my family, my grandfather helped found one of the first NAACP chapters in Florida. And on my mother's side, white American family, they were involved in the suffragette movement. And my great-grandfather supported my great-grandmother in pursuing that objective. So, I mean, we've been a politically engaged, impassioned family for a long time. And so as a child, I certainly was introduced to all the founding documents and participated in family arguments about them. But again, it was, you know, this funny thing of teaching this class that really reconnected me to these documents.
Your father was part of the Reagan administration. You were raised both at the knee of a conservative and became one yourself.
That's true, yes. I was a conservative in college, so I helped edit it. A magazine at Princeton called the Princeton Tory, which is about as conservative as you can get. And I worked for the National Review after the summer of my junior year in college, and that was really the pivotal turning point.
What happened?
So, I mean, a number of different things, but there were just various issues that I sort of sat in editorial meetings, sort of watching people argue about facts, evidence, how to present different issues. And I wasn't convinced by the outcomes of those conversations. So with all due respect to my colleagues at the time then at the National Review, you know, I ended up disagreeing with the choices they made. And some of the key issues, one of the biggest ones was that those were the early days where some of the income inequality data was coming out. And their focus was on trying to tell a story about how social mobility continued, despite the fact that there were these widening gaps in income. And I wasn't convinced by their handling of the evidence and the data. So, you know, that was a kind of key issue that was a pivotal turning point for me.
It's still a key issue.
Well, I mean, now everybody recognizes it.
Yes,
exactly. I mean, we've
course.
Gotten much greater clarity about that. And the issues with social mobility are now evident as well, too. So in that regard, for me, it's been a sort of 20 years unfolding of an issue that caught my attention in the early 90s.
So was there a click in your mind or was it a sort of beginning to rethink and then a gradual process?
Maybe, you know, sort of 50-50, I'd say, between click and gradual. So, you know, there were sort of three or four issues where I felt like there was a click that summer for me. Another one had to do with the history of race in America and the fact that I would tell stories about my grandfather in northern Florida having succeeded as a fisherman until such a point that he did too well, such that then his boat was taken away from him by the sort of white power holders in the small town that he was in. And nobody believed me when I told this story. And it wasn't until a lovely man who himself was from the South, his father had been a judge, who sort of vouched for my story that anybody took me seriously. And that was also a kind of wake-up call. But at any rate, so although there were these moments of epiphany at the time, it was certainly many years unfolding as I began to rethink core ideas.
Now a quick break, then we'll be back with more of my 2014 conversation with Danielle Allen.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my interview with Danielle Allen, author of the book, Our Declaration. Here's an email from Richard. He says, the Declaration of Independence talks about equality of rights. In particular, it opposes special rights or privileges for groups or individuals based on accident of birth, yet Americans get fuzzy in the head when the word rights is introduced into a debate over policy. I got my rights is the cry of the person seeking special privilege.
That's a great question. So, yes, the Declaration focuses on equality of rights, and it is makes the argument that we have equal rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that we require a government as our instrument for pursuing those collectively. So in that regard, too, we need equal access to the instrument of government, and that is often how we've thought about civil rights, is focusing on voting rights and political rights. But it's also the case that the Declaration makes a strong argument about the nature of a political system that can protect those rights. And some of the other features that the Declaration shows us the way to relate, for example, to what I call egalitarian approach to building knowledge. In some sense, it's an idea that connects to education. So when they developed the list of grievances, for instance, it wasn't just a matter of experts working in a closed room. They put ads in all the newspapers soliciting information from everybody about their stories about the British. And that was a practice, a procedure for achieving something based on an idea of equality. So it's also built into the Declaration. One has to ask the question then of how one builds a society where we all have the educational capacities, the education to contribute in that positive way. So the point of saying this is simply to say that there's a lot more about equality in the Declaration than simply the statement of rights in the second sentence. And I think it's worth looking at all the different pieces of the argument about equality in the Declaration.
Here's an email from Teresa. She says, I read the Declaration of Independence this morning. I was struck that one of the complaints about King George III was his making immigration to the colonies and the naturalization of immigration of immigrants hard. This is interesting given the current debate about immigration.
That's right. The colonists recognized that immigration was critical to their achievement of prosperity. And so they were extremely frustrated by the king's efforts to limit immigration, which were an effort to keep the colonies dependent on Great Britain and to keep them weak. So they saw immigration as a source of strength.
She goes on to say another complaint was that he was making it hard for laws necessary for governing to be passed. Also interesting, given the current state of the Congress.
The list of grievances is really brilliant, and it merits paying more attention to. One of the things I love about them is you'll find in them effectively a constitutional theory. First, you get complaints about the legislative function, then you get complaints about the judicial function, then you get complaints about the executive function, and then at the very end, you get complaints about violations of the law of war. So you can turn them inside out, really. You can invert them and tell a positive story about what a theory of constitutionalism amounts to. And it's worth doing that and holding that up next to the Constitution. It's super interesting.
It's so interesting, Danielle, that you talk about the importance of claiming and owning and taking possession of the Declaration. What do you mean?
This government is built out of our consent. It's we, the people, who are its bedrock. And for it to work, we have a responsibility to take ownership of it. And that means participation through and through. So across the board, I think we all need to do a lot more work getting people to turn out for primaries, to turn out for local elections, to turn out for off-year elections. We have a responsibility, and it's only by acting on that responsibility that we can make good on the possibility that these institutions can provide a framework in which we can all flourish, all pursue our happiness.
There is some question about a small but significant what you claim is an error in the official transcript of the document. Tell us about that.
The National Archives transcription published online has a period after pursuit of happiness in the second sentence. In all the manuscripts, we have 8 manuscripts of the Declaration. There is no such thing. So all of the manuscripts treat the list of self-evident truths as consisting of the 5 that clauses that follow it and which end with their safety and happiness at the end of a very long sentence. So we move from individual rights to the use of government as an instrument to secure collectively our safety and happiness. So the question is, there are a couple of questions. Why does National Archives transcription have a period there? And, you know, what should we make of it? The reason they have a period is because the 1823 William Stone engraving used a period after pursuit of happiness. And that's where they take their transcription from, as I understand it. The first printed version of the Declaration by John Dunlap did put a dash after pursuit of happiness, but it treated the whole thing as one sentence. That dash, it would appear, based on my research, comes from an effort to render the emphasis marks that Thomas Jefferson used in his manuscripts to indicate where one should take a longer pause or put more emphasis on a word. So I think it's without question that the men who worked on the Declaration, Jefferson, but also John Adams and Benjamin Franklin, wanted to emphasize the idea of pursuit of happiness, but they didn't want to end the sentence there.
So where does that leave us? Does it in any way change our understanding, our interpretation of that phrase?
I think it's very important. If you don't mind, Diane, I just would like to go ahead and read the whole thing because
certainly,
I think when people hear it, they'll realize that they've usually stopped about one-third of the way through.
Okay.
So I'll just go ahead and read it. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. So the second sentence of the Declaration is very long, and the reason it's very long is because it makes an argument. And that argument is first an argument about individual rights, the fact that we all have them. Then it makes points about how we secure them, namely through government. And finally, it makes points about our responsibility to take charge of our government collectively to work together to secure safety and happiness. So the movement of the argument in the sentence is from our individual rights to what we can do only together by working together through the institutions of government. And that's what one loses, that movement from the individual to the collective, when you put a period after pursuit of happiness. And if you stop reading the sentence there, I think one begins ultimately even to take a sort of, you know, I would go so far as to say self-indulgent view of the Declaration, as if what its story is about is just me, right? Exactly. Each of us, me, figuring out what my happiness is, whereas actually it's a powerful argument about what we need to do together.
Very interesting. Yet, here is an email from Skylar, who says, as an African American, I believe it's challenging to own the Declaration when fundamentally it advocated that all Anglo-Saxon white male Protestant men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with inalienable rights. The Founding Fathers conveniently defined Anglo-Saxon white male Protestants as full-fledged human beings rather than the other races and the female sex. Despite their Enlightenment ideals, the framers still perpetuated the harmful racial gender misconceptions of their day.
I would make 3 points about that one. First, it's worth taking the time to look at the original rough draft of the Declaration, which you can find online. And you'll see in that a passage condemning King George's support of the slave trade, which was then cut out by Congress. But it's important to read it because it describes the king as violating the sacred rights of life and liberty of a distant people. In other words, it uses the same language that it uses in the opening to talk about the colonists' rights, to talk about the rights of Africans who are being taken into slavery. In addition, in that passage that was cut out, it talks about men being bought and sold in slave markets. Now, obviously, when they use the word men there, they mean women and children too, because they're not just talking about males being bought and sold. Women were sold, children were sold, and so forth. So they did use the word men in a universalistic way. We don't use it that way anymore. When I talk about the Declaration now, I talk about how all people are created equal. But you can see in the language, they did actually mean it in a universalistic way. And then I guess the second point I would make, and I'll maybe hold back
but
on the third.
Before you go on, who pulled out? Who put the pressure to take that out?
So Congress took that out in the revisions of the document July 2nd through 4th. So the five committee members had agreed on keeping that language. So they were Jefferson, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Roger Sherman of Connecticut, and Robert Livingston of
Even
New York.
Even though Jefferson owned slaves.
Even though Jefferson
himself.
Owned slaves. Although this is where it's important. So he was the only Southerner on the committee. It was four Northerners. And Adams, a man of Massachusetts, was against slavery, never owned slaves himself. It's really important to see the document of the Declaration as having many voices in it. And you can see these this in many ways. And there's another a declaration from the previous summer, 1775, the Declaration on the Causes and Necessity of Taking Up Arms, where Jefferson had used the language of rights of life and property in it in a draft, and that was taken out by Dickinson, who was chairing the committee, who wrote a draft and argued that the point of government was the welfare of mankind. And that argument about whether property or welfare or happiness should be the main ideal was an argument about slavery. Dickinson was the only of the signers to liberate his slaves in the wake of the signing. And he chose that welfare word because the property word was being used by slaveholders to defend slavery. So when we get life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the opening of the Declaration, we're hearing the voice of John Adams, of Dickinson, and those who are against slavery. That it really is what I like to call a polyphonic document. It's got more than one voice flowing through it.
And that's all for this week. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereen.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden. Comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Ben Privett. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.